Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the stories dominating the headlines. The first story concerns President Donald Trump and the Paris Accords, which he pulled out of 1 month ago. Many environmentalists predicted doom and gloom. However, let's make a sober assessment of what it means when the United States pulls out of the Paris Accords, which President Donald Trump announced last week. Also, it is the 70th anniversary, 70th anniversary of the Roswell incident of 1947. And all over the world, people who believe in UFOs and aliens in outer space are celebrating this event, and they say that that is the birth of their movement. So we'll say a few things about Roswell, flying saucers, UFOs, and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence in outer space. In fact, on Exploration, many times we've had Dr. Seth Shostak on our airwaves. He's the director of the SETI Institute. Is the man responsible for organizing our effort to find intelligent life in outer space, and get this, and he has a new theory. Perhaps the aliens are not going to look like the aliens on Independence Day or War of the Worlds at all. So we'll see a few things about a new theory proposed by the leader of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence about what are the aliens going to look like. How do we find them? Also, speaking about outer space, the solar eclipse is in the news. Just a few days ago, NASA had a major press release stating that, yes, August 21st, write that down on your calendar, August 21st, there'll be an event of the century. For the first time in 99 years, get this, the first time in 99 years, we're going to have a total eclipse of the sun, which will be seen either as a total eclipse or a partial eclipse in the entire continental U.S. of A. Now, of course, there have been other eclipses of the sun. However, none as astounding as this one. This one's going to cut right across the continental United States. And the last one that did that was 99 years ago. And the question is, well, how do you go about seeing it? What maps do you have to use to find out how far you have to journey to find this solar eclipse, and how will you look at it? And for that matter, what is this coincidence, the fact that the moon just perfectly blocks out sunlight? What's the origin of that coincidence? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. It was about a month ago that President Donald Trump made headlines around the world by pulling out of the Paris Accords. And at that time, many environmentalists threw their hands up in the air and said, "Ah, this is the end." Well, a month later, people are beginning to reassess exactly what did happen and what does it mean for the United States and what does it mean for the world. First of all, indeed, it is a setback. The Paris Accords, it took years to negotiate. In fact, it was a revised version of the earlier Kyoto Protocols. Almost 200 nations signed on to the Paris Accords. Many environmentalists hailed it as a step forward to rein in global greenhouse gases. And with 95% confidence, the scientific community says that it is human. It is human activity that is driving the bizarre weather and the weather patterns that we see all around us, leading to a global warming of the planet Earth. Well, doomsday did not happen. So let's now pick apart the pieces. First of all, it takes 3 years to pull out of the Paris Accords. 3 years to pull out. And by that time, we're going to be in the throes of having a new president of the United States. So in other words, whatever happens in the next 3 years will be temporary because there's going to be a new election when the United States actually officially pulls out of the Paris Accords. Second of all, there is tremendous momentum already generated, technological, political momentum that no one nation can stop. For example, one of the main bottlenecks in terms of getting a solar age or a wind power age is the storage. It's not the solar panels. It's not the fact that the winds don't blow at night or in certain times of the year. No, it's the storage of power, that is, the battery. However, battery efficiency has been increasing every year. The price of battery power has been dropping every year because all of a sudden we have all these inventors racing to develop the next generation of batteries. Now, why couldn't they have done that decades ago? They could have. But there was no entrepreneurial spirit. There was no seed money. There were no tax breaks. Now there's a tremendous amount of momentum in order to perfect battery power. And so, in other words, there's a tremendous amount of momentum already built up so that solar power, renewables, wind power, better efficiency, and so on and so forth can be commercialized so that it's not just a fringe movement of wealthy Hollywood people buying solar panels for their house. No. Now, the average homeowner can participate in this revolution, and Elon Musk of Tesla Motors has invested in this new generation of batteries, not just consumers, but also the utilities. The utilities realize that they have to meet peak summer and peak winter demands. However, 99% of the time, it's a waste, but people demand it. So the utilities want an industrial-sized battery that can store power so they don't have to have peak summer and peak winter capability. So industries also want to partake of the battery revolution. Also, other nations. Other nations are not waiting for the United States. Yes, in the past, the United States has been a leader in many areas, especially in the sciences, but not in the environment. But other nations are not waiting for the United States. They are already taking the initiative. Now, of course, there could be a backlash against the Paris Accords. Other nations may say, well, why should we sacrifice? Why should we have to tighten our belts for the United States? The biggest gas guzzler of all is not doing anything. Well, yes, that's the problem. So what are we going to do about it? Instead of throwing up our hands and saying, woe is me, doom and gloom, we have to organize. We have to lobby. And we have to vote. We have to translate our political instincts into political reality. And also, it's the 70th anniversary of the Roswell incident. There are going to be all sorts of TV specials, all sorts of momentum around this event, because it was in July of 1947 that something crashed outside the city of Roswell, New Mexico. What was it? Well, if you visit Roswell, New Mexico today, it's a tremendous amount of hoopla. Shops, stores, souvenir stops everywhere. Everywhere you go, you see museums, and you see people that are interested in aliens from outer space. Well, in exploration several years ago, we had a debate between the leader debunker of UFOs and flying saucers and one of the leading promoters of the Roswell mythology. We had a tit-for-tat debate that lasted for about an hour, and afterwards, people said, wow, a lot of fireworks. That's what we heard. So let me summarize what was said. First of all, we had Phil Kloss, spokesperson for the United States Air Force, saying, bah, humbug. It's all nonsense. It's nothing but a weather balloon that crashed. In fact, it was part of something called Project Mogul. And then he said the Air Force even looked up the logs. Yes, there was a launching of a balloon just a few days before the incident took place. And apparently it disappeared off the radar screens. They lost contact with it. So that's it. There it is in the logs. We know it was a weather balloon. And then the opposite point of view that believes in UFOs say, bah, humbug. Do you believe in the Air Force? I mean, they've been lying to us for decades. Lying to us, covering up, changing their stories left and right. Who knows what really fell outside Roswell, New Mexico? And, of course, the Air Force was trying to protect its own butt. The Air Force was trying to protect the stealth bomber, the flying wing, and all sorts of other different kinds of aeronautical devices. And they were using UFOs as a cover So no wonder the Air Force stories began to change. So the bottom line is, do you trust the Air Force? Well, then the Air Force person came back and said, wait a minute. We have pictures of Project Mogul. We know that the material that crashed was an aluminum-like material, just like the material that were found by the eyewitness accounts. Pictures were taken of the debris, and look, it matches. Obviously, it was a weather balloon. And then the promoters of this whole thing say, now, wait a minute. It's more than just the weather balloon. We're talking about Area 51, an area which has been a subject of a tremendous amount of speculation. The Air Force says, what? Me worry? There's no Area 51. But that's where a nurse claims to have seen the bodies. Now we're talking eyewitness accounts. This nurse, who has everything to lose, says that, yes, she saw the bodies. She saw the alien on a stretcher. Yes, it looked just like in the movies, big eyes, big head. And, yes, it was Area 51. Well, then the military comes back and says, ha, Area 51? Well, yeah, okay. So the Air Force was doing some studies, but, hey, look, you got to give the Air Force a break. If they're going to perfect the stealth bomber, they have to do it someplace. Duh. I mean, where else are you going to test something like a stealth bomber unless you test it in the desert? Because you don't want the Russians to find out about what kind of advanced weaponry that we are fielding. And then the UFO buff comes back and says, ha, you see, you have to admit it. Area 51 does exist because everybody knows it. We have satellite. We have satellite photographs of Area 51. And the military can deny that it exists as much as they want, but hey, we got the goods. We got satellite photographs of Area 51. And then the military comes back and says, now, wait a minute. Let's talk about that alien. In fact, it turns out that years ago, the United States Air Force used to literally throw people out of airplanes miles above the surface of the Earth. They were test pilots who were trying to understand the rigors of being in outer space with a low atmospheric pressure. That's why they volunteered to jump out of an airplane miles up. One of them actually landed quite in a very rough landing. He sustained damage to his internal organs, taken to the hospital, and his face was totally swollen and ballooned. And yes, the Air Force has a photograph of this person. I've seen the photograph. You can actually see it on the web. And by golly, it does look like an alien. The head is large because, of course, when you jump out of an airplane at a high altitude, atmospheric pressure pulls the skin to the outside because you don't have 14.5 pounds per square inch pushing you from the outside in. Your blood pushes out, which means that, yes, you are going to be swollen. And, yes, the eyes were definitely swollen. And by golly, he did look like one of the aliens that you see in the flying saucer movies. Well, then the UFO buff comes back and says, look, the bottom line is we don't believe you because we know from newspapers in Albuquerque, New Mexico, that you guys were dumping uranium dust into people's backyards, using the American people as guinea pigs. And the Air Force person says, well, yeah, but it was national security. We were at the height of the Cold War. It was the late 1940s and 1950s. Everyone thought that World War III was just around the corner. It would be fought with nuclear weapons, and we didn't know anything about fallout. Fallout caught the scientific community off guard. We didn't anticipate fallout, and we had to do tests on fallout. Well, then the UFO person comes back and says, well, okay, why didn't you tell us? Why didn't you inform the American people that uranium dust is going to be spewed outside Cincinnati, Ohio? That outside of Roswell, New Mexico, uranium dust would be sprayed over the landscape, where it would wind up in people's homes, in children's bodies, inhaled into their lungs. You use the American people as guinea pigs. Well, after all is said and done, it went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. These guys are not dummies on either side. Who won? Well, let me give you my own personal point of view. I think overall, the Air Force, well, it did make a strong case. Every single incident involving an alien craft, or whatever, the Air Force came back with pictures, photographs, and documentation showing that, yes, these were Air Force experiments that they now own up to. In fact, there's a booklet which contains all these photographs. And then, well, the critics of the Air Force come back with a very strong case. And they say, the bottom line is, we don't believe you. Yes, why should we believe you now? Now that you come out with a book of all these explanations, when for decades you either denied it or planted false stories, why should we believe you? Well, that's where the interview ended, but it was a rousing debate between the two sides. And let me say a few things about, well, UFOs. First of all, I get a lot of UFO sightings in my emails. And, well, you can show that about 95% of the time, it's an anomaly that you could probably explain. Perhaps it was a meteor streaking across the night sky, a comet, or perhaps it was a weather balloon, or perhaps it was lights from airplanes, or the planet Venus. For example, President Jimmy Carter claimed that he actually saw a UFO. It was sort of like chasing after him when he was driving his car, looking back. The Air Force looked into it and said that, well, if we recreate the night sky during that day when President Jimmy Carter saw a UFO, it's probably the planet Venus. Now, let me explain. We judge distances by moving your head. By moving your head, the mountains don't move that much, but something on your desk moves a lot. That's called parallax, and that's how we humans judge distances by moving our head. However, if something is sitting on our shoulder, like a parrot, for example, it doesn't move, even though it is very close. So the brain gets confused. Objects that don't move are either very, very far away, like a mountaintop, or they're sitting right next to you over your shoulder. That's why children say, "Mommy, Mommy, the moon is chasing me." Well, yes, the moon can chase you, and Venus can also chase you, because when you drive your car and you look over your right shoulder, you see the planet Venus, and no matter how you steer the car, Venus follows you. Therefore, it's not a UFO. It is, in fact, the planet Venus. Now, what about people that have claimed to be abducted by aliens from outer space? Well, there's a theory. I'm not sure if the theory is correct in terms of explaining alien abductions, because, of course, we have reputable people, ministers, school teachers, even policemen that claim that they've been abducted by UFO people. Well, it turns out there's something called sleep paralysis. About 5% or so of the human race suffers from sleep paralysis. And when you go to sleep and you dream, you are paralyzed. That's right, you are paralyzed when you dream. Otherwise, you'd be acting out your dream and causing all sorts of horrible problems. So, some people, about 5% of the population, when they wake up, they are still paralyzed. Most of us are not paralyzed when we wake up. We jump out of bed. However, for 5% of us, we are paralyzed, and we think something is sitting on our chest, preventing us from moving. In fact, in my astronomy class, I asked the class, raise your hand. How many people have had the sensation of being paralyzed when you wake up and thinking there's something on your chest? And sure enough, about 5% of the class raises their hand. So some scientists claim, though it's hard to prove, that alien abduction syndrome is caused by sleep paralysis. That people with sleep paralysis think there's something sitting on their chest, preventing them from moving as if you're being strapped down. You're also slightly sexually excited, according to psychologists, and that would explain the fact that many people believe that forbidden experiments are being done on their sex organs as they're being kidnapped and sent into outer space. Well, it's just a theory. I have yet to see a definitive study done on people with sleep paralysis who claim to have been abducted. However, I have some personal advice, and that is if you are ever abducted by aliens from outer space and taken onto their flying saucer, for God's sake, steal something. I don't care what it is. An alien paperclip, an alien ship, alien DNA, alien dandruff. Steal something. Otherwise, when you come out, there is literally nothing to verify what you said. And now let me just inject my own 2 cents worth in this debate. And that is, I think that, well, 95% of the so-called UFO sightings can be dismissed by looking at the planet Venus, looking at swamp gas, meteors, comets, different kinds of atmospheric disturbances, and lights from airplanes. However, that said, there are the remaining 5%, which are hard to debunk. These are sightings by multiple means by multiple individuals. That is, radar sighting with eyewitness accounts of pilots and passengers on airlines. And so, how do you dismiss that when people on an airplane see something flying next to them? Well, the only thing I can say is maybe it's a stealth bomber. Maybe it's an experimental aircraft made by the Air Force. We don't know for sure because the Air Force is not going to confirm or deny such a sighting. But those are the hardest to debunk. Multiple sightings by multiple modes, by multiple individuals, that you simply cannot dismiss as some crank out there who wants to get his name in the newspaper. Also, it is the 21st anniversary of the movie Independence Day. Yes, Independence Day, when the aliens come and devastate most of the cities of the planet Earth. But, well, we have a secret weapon. We can put a virus in the aliens' flying saucers and cripple them. I mean, come on, give me a break. I mean, as if aliens use Microsoft Windows? Come on. Now, it turns out that Dr. Seth Shostak, who is the director of the SETI project, well, he's been on our airwaves several times. And he admits now that perhaps we were on a wild goose chase. The aliens, yeah, they're out there, he thinks, because we've discovered 4,000 planets orbiting other stars in a one piece of the Milky Way galaxy. Perhaps there could be hundreds of billions of planets in our own backyard. And how do we find them? By looking for two things. One, trying to find oxygen and water vapor in their atmosphere. And two, listening for radio emissions. Now he says he's rethought that. And perhaps we're not looking in the right direction. Because you see, he claims by the time aliens from outer space invent radio, very soon after that, they invent supercomputers. And very soon after that, they become so advanced, they begin to merge with their artificial intelligent creations. They become part cybernetic. And some people say that's already happening now. With cochlear implants, people who are deaf have the option of having it inserted and hearing again. Artificial retinas are possible because we can have TV cameras that can record color images and we can send them to the retina of the eye. So people who are totally blind can see about 60 to 100 pixels with this mechanical device. Not to mention the fact that people who are totally paralyzed can have their entire brain connected to a computer and they can have an Iron Man exoskeleton. So, says Dr. Seth Shostak, there's only a brief period of time between when they first invent radio and computers and they begin to have super advanced computers and robots and they begin to merge with them. There's an advantage to being part robotic, and that is you can explore the universe. You don't have to worry about weightlessness. You don't have to worry about oxygen, about water. You don't have to worry about all these things that astronauts have to prepare for. They could be part cybernetic, part Iron Man with superhuman strength, with supervision, with the ability to breathe on hostile environments with poisonous atmospheres. So he said, maybe we're listening for the wrong thing. Would alien beings that are cybernetic, would they use radio? They may consider radio just like we consider using a hammer and a chisel to write a letter. In other words, they're way beyond radio. They're way beyond oxygen. They're way beyond water vapor. They're part robotic. Well, I don't know. But it is a theory that's causing people in the SETI project to rethink looking for radio signals from outer space. Then NASA, just a few days ago, had a press conference. There is a solar eclipse coming. The last one that was this complete was 99 years ago. Yes, write this down on your calendar. August 21st. It'll be first visible in the western part of the United States. It'll come from the Pacific Northwest through the heartland of America and exit the United States around the Carolinas. And for 3 hours, most places in the United States will be able to see it, even if you can't see the total eclipse. Now, there is a narrow band about 100 miles wide that is the place where the total eclipse is most visible. Go to NASA.gov and you can see the map. However, anywhere in the continental United States, you will be able to see a partial eclipse of the sun. Now, what is the eclipse? The eclipse is when the moon goes between the earth and the sun, and it just covers the sun completely. Now, the ancients, of course, thought this was magic, as if something were eating the sun. But we now know that it's basically a coincidence that the moon perfectly balances the image of the sun. Why is that? Well, the moon is actually leaving us. It's leaving us at the rate of 1.6 inches per year. So, yes, it is an accident that we live in an era where the moon's shadow just covers the disk of the sun. Because it turns out that millions of years ago, when the moon was a lot closer to the planet Earth, the moon could completely blanket the light from the sun. And in the far future, because the moon is leaving us at the rate of 1.6 inches per year, the moon, as it goes in front of the sun, will not eclipse the total disk of the sun. Now, what should you do? Should you look at the sun during a total eclipse with a telescope or with a naked eye? No. Apparently, that's what Galileo did centuries ago, and he actually burned part of his retina, and he eventually went blind in that eye. So I highly recommend that you do not look directly at the sun or, for God's sake, through a telescope, which makes it even worse. So how should you see it? Well, get a pair of darkened sunglasses that are especially dark, or a pinhole telescope. Get a piece of paper, punch a hole in it, and look at the shadow of the sheet of paper and the pinhole, and you'll see on the second sheet of paper the image of the total eclipse of the sun. And so there are ways of seeing the total eclipse of the sun without going blind in one eye, which is apparently what happened to Galileo centuries ago. Concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. In the second half of Exploration, we're going to rebroadcast an interview with a Nobel Prize winner, Professor Pollack, who won the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in other words, the Nobel Peace Prize. And so we're going to talk about a world without ice. What happens when the polar ice caps melt? What happens when we have a massive disruption of the ecology of the Earth? What happens when sea levels begin to rise and inundate our cities? Again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the second half of Exploration, we're delighted to have Professor Henry Pollack, a Nobel Prize winner. He was one of the lead authors in that paper from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that won the Nobel Peace Prize. and we're going to bring him on today. It's a pre-recorded interview with Professor Henry Pollack, who's a professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and we're going to talk about his book, A World Without Ice. What would it mean if the poles begin to collapse? What does it mean if sea levels begin to rise? What happens if global warming runs amok? And so once again, we're going to be talking about worst-case scenarios. But once again, with us today is a Nobel Prize winner, Professor Henry Pollack, talking about a world without ice. And it's a world that you may not want to live in.
Professor Pollack, how did you, as a child, first get interested in science?
I grew up during World War II, and every day in the newspaper there were maps of the front in Europe and in Asia and the Pacific, and I just grew very fond of maps and looking at the geography around the globe. And that, in a sense, I think is characteristic of all of my adult research interests, trying to stand back and get a global viewpoint. Not just of climate science, but in all the scientific endeavors that I've been involved with in a long career, I've always tried to get a global perspective.
And why geophysics, and specifically, why the weather?
Well, I've not always been interested in the climate. I'm actually not a meteorologist, but my focus on the world's weather really is in the world's climate, which is the long-term average of what the weather gives us. And that's only an interest that has developed in the last two decades. Prior to that, I had done research in seismology, study of earthquakes. I've done work in taking the Earth's temperature to measure the amount of heat coming out from the interior and its relationship to earthquakes and volcanism. But in the last decade and a half or so, I realized that the rock temperatures that I had been taking for other purposes was also telling us something about what's happening at the Earth's surface. And we were able to reanalyze a lot of that data and reconstruct what the surface temperature of the Earth looked like for about the past 500 years, which conveniently takes us into the pre-industrial era. So there have been many transitions in my scientific interests. All of them, of course, are within the broad realm of Earth science.
Okay, now let's talk about ice. Why is ice so important? Some people say, ha, nothing but polar bears and penguins. Why ice?
Well, ice is important, and the number one reason that it's important is that it plays a big role in the global climate system. Ice is a white substance, and it's very reflective. And the more ice there is on the planet, the less sunshine warms the Earth because it is reflected directly back to space. With less ice, more sunshine falls on the solid Earth and warms us up. So the amount of ice is a very big player in how much sunshine the Earth absorbs.
And
the second reason that ice is important is that it's a very sensitive and unambiguous indicator of climate change, because ice on our planet is very close to its melting point. Small changes in the temperature cause very visible changes in the amount and geography of ice on the planet. And so it is what I call nature's best thermometer, because it is very, very sensitive to climate change. And then the third reason that ice is important, because as you lose it, important things happen on Earth. The first ice to go will be the mountaintop glaciers in the tropics and the mid-latitudes. And those glaciers today provide agricultural and domestic water to almost a third of Earth's population. That's a very large number of people who rely on that water for their well-being. And the other aspect, of course, of melting ice is that the water eventually runs into the ocean and raises sea level. It's not the only factor that raises sea level. The warming of the ocean water also leads to sea level rises. But sea level rising will, in simple terms, produce climate refugees, and that will be a very serious social problem as we displace people from the coastal region.
And doesn't ice also help to regulate the weather? When we watch the weather in the evening, we see the jet stream coming from the Arctic. So doesn't all that huge mass of cold air also help to regulate the world's weather?
Well, it does indeed. I would in no way minimize the importance of ice in our daily affairs as reflected through the weather. My emphasis has been on the longer-term trends, which we interpret in terms of slow climate change.
Okay, now let's take a look at the data. What evidence do we have that ice is thinning, that glaciers are receding, and what about ice cores that can take us hundreds of thousands of years back into the past?
Well, let's talk first about the evidence for ice receding. We have photographic evidence of mountain glaciers around the globe taken from the times when the camera was first available in the 19th century, more or less, that showed the position of ice in glacial valleys. And throughout the decades and, in fact, throughout the 20th century, there are many repeat photographs of glaciers. And so you can just visibly see them receding in their valleys. So it's just visual photographic evidence of that loss of ice. Now, in the Arctic region, the sea ice in the Arctic is simply frozen seawater. We call that sea ice, and it's not very thick. It's on the order of 5 to 10 feet, sometimes a little more than that. But in the summertime, it tends to break up some, and then in the wintertime, it refreezes. But the extent of the summertime breakup has been changing dramatically in the last few decades. We have now only about half the area of sea ice in the summer that we had in the middle of the 20th century, and it's getting thinner as well. The average thickness of sea ice in the Arctic is only half of what it was a half century ago. And so we're faced with the prospect of perhaps an Arctic Ocean that is free of ice in the summertime in just a few decades. So that, too, is a very visible change. There, the observations come from satellites that can look down over the entire Arctic. Now, you asked about the ice cores. Ice cores are a form of sedimentary rock, if you like to think of that, because they have layers that form each year from new snowfall. And as next year's snowfall falls on top of that, it compresses the layers underneath it into ice. And so we have a layer-by-layer, year-by-year history locked up in the ice. But in the case of the Antarctic, the record is almost 800,000 years long. And we are able to tease out of the chemistry of the ice the temperature at which the snow fell at that given year. And another very interesting aspect of those ice cores is that as the snow is compacted and recrystallized into ice, it traps little bubbles of air, which are samples of the atmosphere at the time that the snow fell. And so we are able to chemically analyze the atmosphere year by year, going back almost a million years, to recover the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere over long periods of time. What we've learned from that is that the concentration of greenhouse gases today is well beyond the range of natural variability over the past 800,000 years. The ups and downs that Earth's climate has experienced in the last 800,000 years have never gone as high in carbon dioxide as the concentration in the atmosphere is today. So it reveals that we're in the middle of a big inadvertent experiment with the chemistry of the atmosphere and its effects on the global climate that humans have just recognized and are now having to cope with.
And isn't it true that carbon dioxide levels and temperature levels in these ice cores are like two roller coasters in tandem going up and down almost simultaneously over hundreds of thousands of years.
You're absolutely right. That's a wonderful description of it. And what the significance of that is that the temperature of the atmosphere and the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere are very closely coupled. And when one moves, it will pull the other along with it. And in the present day, what is doing the tugging is that we have increased the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dramatically, and it is now pulling the temperature along with it. And that's, of course, what we're recognizing as global warming.
So let's now discuss the South Pole. We hear reports of gigantic parts of the pole breaking off the size of, let's say, the state of Rhode Island. Could you elaborate?
Sure, I could. There is a lot of ice on Antarctica. It has probably 90% of the global ice. And it is stacked up in places almost 10,000 feet thick and spilling off of the continent and into the sea and building up pools of ice called ice shelves. And these ice shelves are big. You mentioned the size of Rhode Island. Actually, the Ross Ice Shelf on the New Zealand side of Antarctica is as big as France. So these are huge pools of ice. And what we're discovering, what we're observing, is that these ice shelves are becoming unstable and breaking up and dislodging huge amounts of floating ice into the ocean currents around Antarctica. And this ice loss is at a pace that we've not seen before in human history. And so you're looking at instability. The understanding of what's causing it includes both warming, of course, from above, but the seawater is also warming and undermining these ice sheets from below and leading to their breakup. Once they break up, the glaciers that feed them from the interior no longer have a barrier in front of them. And so the glaciers themselves are now speeding up and spilling more ice into the sea. So we see the whole process accelerating as both the air and the ocean water are warming.
And speaking of a spiral effect, the tundra of Siberia is frozen, but as it thaws out, it releases methane gas, which is even worse than carbon dioxide as a global warming gas. Could you elaborate on the positive feedback if tundra begins to melt and release methane, which then heats up the Earth again?
Well, I certainly can. First, there's no question that the tundra is beginning to melt. There's a term called tundra travel days, which indicate how many days of the year you can drive across the frozen tundra because it is frozen. And that number, the tundra travel days, has been diminishing and is now measured in months, not just days, of reduction in tundra travel time. So there's no question that the tundra is softening up and melting. Methane is coming out. There have been measurements made in Siberia and in Alaska of the release of gases from the frozen tundra, and it does contain a great deal of methane, which is indeed another greenhouse gas, more powerful than carbon dioxide, but also it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. So there is a little bit of a trade-off on that. But the amount of methane that is coming out, as I say, the measurements are just now beginning to be made, and the projections or the models of how this might proceed require that the tundra melt from the top down. And so it's a very slow process of diffusing heat downward into the permafrost. And I guess the good news is that that process, while it will deliver quite a bit of methane, will be spread out over centuries and probably not be a catastrophic release of methane that would lead to an instantaneous enhancement of the greenhouse blanket.
Okay, now let's take a look at the worst-case scenario. Now, remember, this is the worst-case scenario. No one is saying that this is actually going to happen. But the worst case scenario in 50 years and 100 years, assuming that governments do nothing, that it's business as usual, population grows, economic activity grows. So again, with the caveat that this is a worst case scenario, 50 years from now, what happens to sea levels? I'm in Manhattan right now. Yep. What happens to coastal cities? What happens to the breadbaskets of the world? And then 100 years from now, what are your thoughts?
There are actually three scales, time scales associated with ice loss. There's the decadal time scale, and in that period of time, the next two or three decades, we're going to see the loss of mountain glaciers everywhere in the world. We're going to see the ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime and the issues associated with opening that up to commercial activity. So that's on the decadal time scale, the loss of mountain glaciers and the summertime Arctic Ocean being free of ice and open for commercial activity. On the century-long time scale, we're talking about losing ice in substantial amounts from Greenland and from West Antarctica. Antarctica actually has kind of two geographic regions, the West and the East. The East has the biggest pile of ice, and the West, a smaller pile of ice about the same size as Greenland itself. Now, both Greenland and West Antarctica, each one has the potential of about 20 feet of sea level rise. If we were to lose the ice from Greenland, sea level would rise 20 feet. If we were to lose the ice from West Antarctica, sea level would rise 20 feet. And any partial loss from both could also equal, many feet. So that is on the century-long time scale. And we're already seeing the early hints of that in the acceleration of ice loss from both Greenland and West Antarctica. Now, the big kahuna in all of this is East Antarctica, which has probably the equivalent of something on the order of 200 feet of sea level rise if we were to lose the ice from East Antarctica. But that ice loss, at least at the moment, seems to be on a millennial time scale, over 1,000 years or so. So that aspect of it is probably more delayed than in the future. But the 20th century alone could have several feet of sea level rise, and that will be may have very substantial impacts on coastal communities everywhere. Well, coastal cities everywhere, of course, will be vulnerable to rising sea levels. And you don't need to have 10 feet of sea level rise to have a catastrophe. Just a few feet of sea level rise makes every coastal city more vulnerable to storm surges from what might in the past have been ordinary types of storms and hurricanes. But with higher sea level, everything is more vulnerable. In New York, of course, it's the subway system that is most vulnerable, because once water starts to encroach on Manhattan and the other boroughs, you're going to quickly find you have huge problems with the underground transport system. And there will be aspects of water supply issues that rising sea levels have on coastal communities that draw some of their water from the subsurface. And in areas that have a really flat terrain, such as the major river deltas of the world, particularly those in Asia, the Indus River, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, the Irrawaddy, all of those have very flat terrains that just a few feet of sea level rise will lead to inundation many miles inland and displacement of a great number of residents and loss of agricultural land.
And what happens to a nation like Bangladesh?
Well, that's a wonderful, I shouldn't say wonderful, but it's a spectacular example of a very flat country that will suffer widespread inundation and displacement of tens of millions of people. And it's, we have some experience with climate refugees in the USA following the Hurricane Katrina flooding of New Orleans. There we have had to address the issues with involving 150,000 people. That will, such a tiny fraction of the numbers that will be displaced if we have a few feet of sea level rise in Bangladesh, where it will be in the tens of millions. The difficulties we had addressing climate refugees from Katrina will pale compared to the magnitude of the displacement from sea level rise the world over.
Okay, now let's take a look at some of the critics of this phenomenon, including physicist Freeman Dyson at Princeton. He has two criticisms. He first of all says that rising carbon dioxide levels are actually good for plants. Plants will thrive under that situation. And second, more serious, he says that we don't really know how much carbon dioxide is absorbed by the Amazon and by forests and by plants and by algae. And until we have a good handle on the recycling of carbon dioxide through plants, then perhaps these computer models are premature. What are your thoughts?
Well, let me address both of those. The first issue that plants will love it is kind of a facetious response, I think. It is true that carbon dioxide is the food for photosynthesis and that green plants do take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and metabolize and give us oxygen as a waste product. But it's not that plants need only carbon dioxide to thrive. They need the appropriate amounts of the right kind of nitrogen. They need water availability. And in many, many places and cases, carbon dioxide is not the limiting factor for plant growth. Moreover, it's not only the plants that we might want that will thrive. Well, they'll also see many weeds that will also thrive and in some cases overtake the vegetation that we might be seeking to enhance. A third aspect of it is that even if some agricultural production might increase, it won't always be in the same place that it was previously because the temperatures are changing as well. And so we're going to see displacements, geographic displacements of agriculture, and that alone will be a social disruption across the agricultural world. So I think that far from being a blessing, some people say that it's a return to the Garden of Eden, but it will hardly be the case. There are many, many more factors than just the availability of carbon dioxide. Now, about his reluctance to do anything until we understand better the uptake of carbon dioxide by the forests of the world, I think that's short-sighted. The one thing that we do know is that the forests of the world are not able to take up as much as we're putting into the atmosphere because the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been climbing. As I mentioned earlier, it has climbed out of the range of natural variability of the climate system by a great, great deal. And so whatever the role of the green plants of the Earth are, we're overwhelming them with carbon dioxide far beyond what they're able to take up and leading to warming and melting of ice and rising sea levels. So I think we don't have the luxury of waiting to see how the natural world evolves and how it may help in the take-up. I certainly endorse the idea of storing carbon in plants and in algae, and there are experiments underway for large-scale reforestation and for fertilization of the oceans. But none of these experiments that are underway have given us the promise that we have time to spare and we can wait and see how they work out. We really don't have that much time to spare because the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is growing well beyond the ability of the natural world to pull it out.
And what do you say to the critics who say that it's just the sun? The sun is getting hotter. What are your thoughts?
Well, as a good scientist, the usual response is that, well, let's examine that possibility. Let's measure the radiative output from the sun across the full spectrum of wavelengths that the sun is sending energy to Earth. And the measurements of that over the last half century have actually shown that the sun's radiant energy delivery to Earth is slightly diminished. And if it was only the sun that was affecting climate, Earth would have actually been cooling some in the last half of the 20th century and the beginning decade of the 21st. But the measurements show that far from cooling, Earth is actually warming. So the proper way of addressing the causes is to ask, what are the likely factors, both natural and anthropogenic, and try and make measurements of each of them, assess their contribution. And when you do that, you quickly discover that the natural factors have fallen short in terms of accounting for the warming of the last half of the 20th century and that continues today. So the sun, of course, plays a big role in Earth's climate, and it always has. And we want to learn as much about the variability of the solar radiation as possible. But the extensive measurements that we have of that energy from satellites that are orbiting above Earth's atmosphere, so we don't have any atmospheric effects or detractions from it, it's showing that the sun has not been behind the warming that we're observing.
And some of the critics say that, okay, the Earth is heating up. They'll admit that now. But then they say that it's not human activity. It's a natural cycle. So do you have any, smoking gun that shows that it's human activity and not a natural thing?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I want to, make people who say that acknowledge that there is a possibility of a human signature first. And I'll give you an analogy that I use in that regard. I always ask, were there ever forest fires before there were people on Earth? And the answer, of course, is yes. We know that lightning can start forest fires, and it did that long before there were people.
That's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Our special guest today was Professor Henry Pollack, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize because of his report with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's a professor at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.